الصلوات على محمد وآل محمد.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. We seek the protection of God from Shaytan, who has been expelled from God's kingdom of special grace and mercy because of his arrogance and his defiance. If we avoid these satanic habits of arrogance, whatever we know to be true, we submit. And if we avoid the satanic habit of defiance, whatever we know to be evil, we don't commit. And if we have reliance on God, definitely we shall be granted the strength to be able to identify, to oppose, and to overcome Shaytan and his temptations. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. We humbly turn to God and ask for his special grace and guidance, because he is the all-perfect being. Nobody can achieve any perfection or any goodness until and unless Allah wills it so. And we turn to him because he is Rahman. His grace and mercy and love and attention and care reaches out to each and everything in the universe. It brings it to life, sustains it, and enables it to grow towards its goal of perfection. And we turn to him because he is Rahim. His extra love and care and abundant reward, ending, unending, everlasting, unimaginable, is available here in the dunya and in the akhirah, but exclusively for those of us who believe in him, who submit to his will, who live by his dictates, and who are ready to die for it. Alhamdulillah, wa salatu wa salam ala sayyidina wa nabiyyina Muhammad wa alihi tahirin. And we send our salutations and greetings on the Holy Prophet and on his holy progeny, who are the best guides for mankind till the end of time. Respected scholars, elders, brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Tonight we commemorate the memory of Hazrat Abul Fadl Abbas ibn Ali, Amir al-Mu'mineen, alayhi salam. The status of Hazrat Abbas is so great that his nephew, Imam Zainul Abidin alayhi salam, praises him. He says that, Rahimallahu Ammi al-Abbas. May Allah have special grace and mercy on my uncle Abbas. فَلَقَدْ آثَرَ What made him outstanding was his supreme self-sacrifice. وَأَبْلَى And he underwent a tremendous test and suffering and trial. وَفَدَى أَخَاهُ بِنَفْسِهِ And he sacrificed himself for his brother. Of course, his brother as a representative of God, and therefore in the way of God. And therefore, he occupies a very high station in Jannah. Inna lil Abbasi inda Allahi manzila, a status which is unique. Yaghbituhu biha jami'u shuhada. All the other martyrs, they envy that status. The martyrs, that means of the early history of Islam, Badr, or the martyrs even in Karbala, other than Imam Hussein alayhi salam. The next supreme martyr is Hazrat Abbas alayhi salam. The question, of course, is what is it that makes him outstanding? According to this riwayah, it's his sacrifice. But everybody came and gave sacrifice at Karbala. But there's something unique about the sacrifice given by Hazrat Abbas. Excuse me. The same praise also appears in the ziyarah taught to us by the other imams. When we make ziyarah of Hazrat Abbas, We say أشهد لك بالتسليم والتصديق والوفاء والنصيحة لخلف النبي صلى الله عليه وآله. I testify, O Abbas, that you are in total submission. One, you acknowledged and accepted the status of the Imam. Two, you were totally loyal. Three, and you had the highest of selflessness and goodwill and sacrifice for your brother, the representative and the successor of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi. And in the ziyarah, we are taught that because of your status, therefore, I've come to you to pay my respect. I've come here to take inspiration from you. وَقَلْبِي مُسَلِّمٌ لَكْ. My heart is submitted to you, and I'm obedient to you, and I'm following the same path as you. وَأَنَا لَكُمْ تَابِعْ وَنُصْرَتِي لَكُمْ مُعَدَّةِ. My help is ready anytime when it is required. فَمَعَكُمْ مَعَكُمْ لَا مَعَ عَدُوِّكُمْ. I'm with you all the time, and not with your enemy and your opponent. So by corollary, therefore, the enemy and the opponent would be the one who is selfish, the one who is individualistic, the one who is concerned about himself, the one who is limited in the physical and in the material world. And thirdly, excuse me, the same emphasis appears again in Ziyarat al-Nahiyah by the 12th Holy Imam. السلام على أبي الفضل العباس ابن أمير المؤمنين المواسي أخاه بنفسه. The one who sacrificed himself for his brother. So this spirit of sacrifice, of sharing, of giving, of preferring the other over yourself seems to be a common feature of all the shuhada, but in the case of Hazrat Abbas alayhi salam, it was at the highest level, and therefore we praise him. In order to put this message in context, allow me to remind ourselves once again of the analysis that was presented by this British psychologist Oliver James about the predicament of Western civilization, especially the English-speaking countries, where he says that there is selfish capitalism, which has led to the increase in the emotional distress that they are facing. And incidentally, he says it is not indigenous to the local Europeans. It is anyone who comes into this civilization, he also begins to suffer the same. He says studies have demonstrated that when people emigrate to, let's say, the Western countries, within a few generations, they begin to exhibit the same levels of emotional distress as the levels of the local indigenous population. Why? Because they also begin to develop the same habits, the same attitudes, and the same behaviors of the local adoptive nation. So for example, he says if you study the Nigerians, when they move to the United States, he moves there, he settles down, he raises a family, the first generation, the second generation, the grandchildren. To the extent that they become Americanized, or in other cases Europeanized or Westernized, they develop the same habits and lifestyles and attitudes and behaviors. To that extent, they develop the American, European, Western levels of emotional distress. So for those who believe that, oh, it's the genes and there is a powerful influence of the genes about how much distress you're going to suffer, that's not true. Finally, it's the adopted lifestyle that is the crucial factor. James says, just like smoking, tobacco smoking is related to lung cancer, and over decades of studies it has been shown very clearly, but the governments were slow to accept the results and then to legislate prohibition and health hazards. So also they are slow to recognize this link between this selfish capitalism and the emotional distress. He says because of the the westernized life, what happens is there's a change from the extended family to a nuclear family. Parents and grandparents now are less likely to be closer to this new young developing couple. Relatives are scattered and dispersed in the city. Neighbors, the neighborhood in which you stay, the neighbors are unrelated to you by blood. And that reciprocity and mutual help and sharing and sacrifice that used to be there in the rural setting, not in the urban setting, especially in hard times, it begins to show this lack of reciprocity, in that when, especially when there is no safety net, and if you're living in a government which provides no welfare support, the rates of robbery and theft begin to increase. In this culture, James says that the relationship of parents and children becomes unstable. The rates of divorce increase and separation. There is loss of social cohesion. There is more social isolation. There is a fractured relationship. And that begins to lead to the neglect of children. In fact, in worst cases, the abuse of children, and also the neglect of the elderly, and in worst cases, the abuse of the elderly. This is the result of the capitalist lifestyle. Essentially, it is the replacement of collectivism, sharing, cooperation, concern, compassion, sacrifice, replacement of this with individualism. So the child is now being raised to realize that his identity is through his supreme excellent academic performance, and by his identity is by his career, not because of what he does to the family and how he relates to the family or his social community or his background. The new system of education, James says, divides the new generation from the older generation. The new generation is less respectful of the older generation. It's less obedient to the older generation. The religious observance goes down. And he says, if you're looking for proof, he says, the clearest proof can be seen in the rates of schizophrenia. International studies, wherever in the world, schizophrenia has been studied. It has been found that in urban, industrialized settings, the rates of schizophrenia are higher. In rural settings, the prevalence is lower. And in case they do get afflicted, the recovery rates are higher. And the recurrence rates are even lower. And in the urban setting, the longer the duration of urban dwelling, the higher the risk of schizophrenia. Oh, but it could be determined by genes. No. Urban setting has been found to be 4 times more riskier in the development of schizophrenia than having a mother afflicted with schizophrenia. He says there's something about urbanization. There's something about industrialization. There's something about capitalism that is leading to this. Or he says, take another example, depression. If you compare the rates of depression in America and Nigeria, it's the same story. Urban setting, depression rates higher. Rural setting, the rates are lower. Excuse me. The same thing applies to the European mainland. In the UK, he says, in England, the rates of depression in the city are twice as higher than in the rural setting. Well, urbanites are more stressed about their housing, about their marriage, about their work life, about their child rearing, about personal safety, about the isolation, and about the disconnectedness from the community. And then he concludes, and this is a damning statement. He quotes a study by Kleinman, Arthur Kleinman. He says the hundreds of diseases which have been listed, the mental illnesses, which have been listed down in the psychiatric manuals, 3/4 of them, they are found exclusively in in Americans and in westernized elites, irrespective of whether you are of a European background or a non-European background. It's the westernized elite who suffer these three quarters of these hundreds of mental illnesses listed down by the psychiatric manuals. Multiple personality disorder, eating disorder, chronic fatigue syndrome, all of them. All of them are largely caused by industrialization. Virtually unknown in the pre-industrialized communities. Conclusion, Oliver James says, so industrialization gives us a lot of material benefits. There is no generation in the history of the world, he says, who are better fed, better housed, better transported, better medically treated, etc., etc., all the material benefits than our generation. But, well, that's the benefit, but the industrialized developed nations are probably much more prone to develop emotional distress than any other nation. Today, no, any other nation in the history of the world. Oh, that's a damning statement if ever there is one about the failure of the Western civilization in this particular area. And these are experts themselves. So he says, if you happen to be an American or a European, let me qualify that properly. If you happen to be Americanized, irrespective of what your skin color is and your racial background is. If you happen to be Europeanized, if you happen to be Westernized, studies have shown everywhere, Sweden, New Zealand, Germany, Canada, all places, you are more likely to suffer depression. 3 times more likely than back in the 50s. No, perhaps even 10 times more likely to suffer depression now than back in the 50s. Something is going wrong somewhere. So then he quotes a thinker, a psychoanalyst, a German intellectual who migrated during the war times to America and settled down, Eric Fromm. Fromm diagnoses and analyzes the situation in the post-war affluent America. Oliver James says what Fromm spoke about the America in the 50s is almost exact of Europe, of Britain, for example, in the first decade of the 21st century. So Fromm says, you see the literacy rates, they're 90% and above. Every American has access to radio or TV or newspaper. But instead of them giving this media means of communication, instead of giving us the best of the literature, past literature or present literature or music, these same means of communication, the media, they supplemented by advertisements, they are filling our minds with cheap trash. They're turning us into individuals who lack a sense of reality. They are fueling sadistic fantasies, which Fromm says a halfway cultured person would be embarrassed to entertain even once in his lifetime. Fromm continues that the status of man, the true status of man, is not one who has much, but is one who is much. It's not the external possessions that will give me my true happiness. It'll lead me to distress. It's my internal development that'll give me happiness, he says. Material possessions, unfortunately, he says, they end up controlling us. He says, in this society, we have become marketing characters. Our value depends on external material success, on our saleability, how much we can sell ourselves, and how much approval we can get, outward approval. And incidentally, Oliver James says, this sellability of a personality, this has become a multi-billion-dollar industry right now. And there are experts who can assess your personality of your employability, marketability. And they'll tell you all those characteristics which can make you successful, everything in the material, physical world. So Fromm says the danger of this trend in society is that now our inner abilities, our skills of performance are not sufficient. We must be able to put ourselves across in a very competitive world with many others who all vying for success. And therefore now our concern is not for our inner happiness, it's for the external possessions. Fromm then concludes, the crisis of the modern society is that the members of this society have become selfless instruments whose identity and success depends in becoming members of this greater organization or corporation. Worse than that, Oliver James then adds a comment here. He says that studies are showing that being clever and being smart and academically excellent is not enough now in this competitive, materialistic, success-seeking society. You don't only need to be smart, but you must have traits of Machiavellianism and chameleonism. That means you play with your appearances, and you can use evil ways to eliminate your rivals. You use all the evil methods just to get your goals. So what matters now is what things will give me comfort, will give me fame, will give me success, will give me honor and prestige. So things have no value per se. It's to the extent that me, the individual selfish being, is being served by this thing. Or not only things, even people, even friends, even partners, they're all expendable, they're all commodities, they're all to serve me, the individual, the selfish me. And he quotes from once again, he says, a lot of what goes on as love and romance and relationships is basically just the inner greed to seek approval and success. So we need someone to tell us, not only at 4 o'clock, but at 8 o'clock and at 10 o'clock and at 12 o'clock, how good you are and how fine you are and how all right you are, and you are all doing well. And the main question therefore has turned out to be, am I loved? Meaning, am I approved and am I admired and am I protected? The main question should be, Fromm says, can I love? Do I have the inner human perfection, not the external trappings of success? So he says this is a recipe for individuals of this society to become passive, to become empty from within, to become anxious, to become isolated people who have, for whom life has no meaning now, people who are profoundly alienated. They are bored inside. Fromm says, boring? It's a contradiction. He says, if you were to ask him, are you unhappy and are you bored with life? And he will say, not at all. We are very happy. We go on trips, we can eat as much and whatever we want, and we can drink, and we can buy and buy and buy more for ourselves. But he says, Fromm says, but this is all a facade, it's all an appearance. These people are anxious, these people are alienated, they're compensating their alienation and their anxiety with this consumption, with this compulsive, selfish, narcissistic consumption. And modern gadgets, this is Fromm talking in the 50s. Modern gadgets, they have saved time for us, yes, but the modern man doesn't know what to do with his time. So what does he do now, the extra time that he has gotten because of the mechanization? So he kills his time, Fromm says, by, in some respectable way. So now there is the whole entertainment industry, and there is the leisure activities, and then there are parties. And the problem with all this is that it's nothing but an attempt to do away with the inner boredom that he is suffering. He calls it the necrophilia. Necrophilia meaning the state of the mind whereby it's attracted to things which are cheap and empty, which do nothing to develop us internally. Oliver James says, people who live to have, to possess, to get more, all the external trappings of success, they are emotionally necrophilic. And the worst thing is, this consumptive, selfish, narcissistic lifestyle, it's a monster that feeds on the other. That means, the more the inner anxiety, the more consumption. The more the consumption, the more the anxiety. It's a vicious circle. It's a trap. It's a downward spiral that goes on deeper. And there is this false promise of the external pleasures to compensate for the internal lack. So, in order to be able to afford all these external pleasures and trappings of success, you need to increase your pay. So you need to work more. And work by its nature is alienating, and that creates even more anxiety. So irrespective of whether you are a staff member or you're a freelance worker in an organization, you experience alienation because you consider yourself as part, as just like a cog in a huge machine. If you don't do the work, you are afraid that somebody else will come and replace you. And this greed and this desire which is being fueled, it's a limitless, bottomless pit. And the materialistic society depends on sustaining this limitless greed. Because people should buy more. And therefore the demand will increase. Therefore the factories should produce more. Therefore the capitalist capital will multiply. So the capitalist will say, we will use all means available to make sure that we fuel the temptation in you to consume more and more, to become more selfish, more narcissistic, more individualistic, and therefore more depressed and more anxious and more alienated and more isolated. It's a vicious circle. Conclusion. Oliver James says we live in a sick society, a profoundly sick society. Oh, but you say, well, the psychiatrists don't tell us that it's so sick. He says, well, the yardstick or the criteria being used by the psychiatrists are not adequate. Fromm says that nothing is more common in the 20th century Western world than the idea that we people in the Western world are eminently sane and rational. Then Fromm says, wait a minute. Can we be so sure that we are not deceiving ourselves? You go to an asylum, the inmates of an insane asylum, they are also convinced that everyone is crazy except for themselves. So, and he says, you think I am conjuring up an analysis of the society? There is insanity. How do you explain 20th century Western world produced the most massive, horrendous crime? 100 million people killed in world wars? Where's the explanation? And look at the increase in suicide and alcoholism and homicide, he says. This is the 50s, how? And he says, look at the economic system. An economic system which, for some selfish reasons, is ready to destroy extra products or produce just in order to keep price when there are people in the world who need those produce. An economic system which thrives on producing weapons of mass destruction at a high profit. There's something terribly wrong. We are in a sick society, he says. But there's a big problem. You don't hear these things in the mass media. It's not in fashion to talk about the Western society in this way. In the 1993 edition by Routledge Classics of this book written in the 50s, in the preface, David Ingleby says that you won't find this book of Eric Fromm in the university library shelves. You'll find it in those alternative bookshops. The intellectuals of today, he says, are busy. They're too pragmatic. They're trying to make a living, or they are immersed in some sort of hopelessness. They're just like the neurotic who has been to different therapists, and all the therapies have failed, and now they've stuck to one therapist who somehow, a counselor who is giving them time, and somehow they find some comfort with this. Basically, the intellectuals of our day have lost confidence, the Western intellectuals, in the direction of the Western civilization. My God, that's a damning statement. And there is an accompanying loss of faith in how to diagnose the problem of the civilization and how to treat the problem of the civilization. There is a depoliticization of politics. All the intellectuals have been removed from the political parties. The market consultants have come in. They're working with the image now, not with the ideas. They're working with the style, not the substance. Finally, concluding statement. Eric Fromm proposes that we should develop a system of universal criteria that can apply to all nations everywhere, to all peoples. Relatedness, transcendence, that means non-material truth, rootedness, community, a sense of identity, morality, first-hand experience, not depersonalized second-hand experiences. These are the roots and the bases of the new civilization if the Western world is to save itself. But at the core and the root of it, the capitalism that leads to selfishness. That's the basic problem. And hence, therefore, you appreciate why it's important for us to learn from Karbala, from Hazrat Abbas alayhi salam, the spirit of sharing, of sacrifice, of selflessness. It's so important. It is the cure. It is the salvation of the biggest problem of the dominant civilization of the world today. In the Quran, there are several surahs which emphasize this spirit of sharing, of giving, of sacrifice. For example, Surah Hadid, the messages that you must distribute the wealth that you have. You must detach to the attachments and bonds that you've developed with the material possessions. Surah Hashr, you must share. Not only you must share, but you must sacrifice. Surah Saf, if you are a true believer, you must contribute. Surah Jumu'ah, if you are the beloved of God, if you want to become the beloved of God, then be ready to detach. Surah Taghabun, chapter 64. Obey God, spend in the way of God. Let me read one or two of these verses to give us that sense of the importance of sharing and contribution and sacrifice. Surah Taghabun is chapter 64. Ayah number 16 and ayah number 17. Allah says, إِنَّمَا أَمْوَالُكُمْ وَأَوْلَادُكُمْ فِتْنَةً. Your children and your wealth and your possessions are a means to test you. They are a means to recognize that it has been given by God. It is for the purpose of your development. It depends on how you use it. It depends on how you share it. And thereby you grow and you develop. And that's the test. وَاللَّهُ عِنْدَهُ أَجْرٌ عَظِيمٌ. Whatever pleasure that you seek by keeping and hoarding and by not spending and not sharing, Allah gives you a greater reward if you share and if you give. فَاتَّقُوا اللَّهَ مَا اسْتَطَعْتُمْ. Therefore be God mindful and be God conscious as much as you can. وَاسْمَعُوا وَأَطِيعُوا. Listen to the commands. Obey and submit to the commands. وَأَنْفِقُوا. And spend. خَيْرًا لِأَنفُسِكُمْ. This is the best for you. وَمَنْ يُوقَ شُحَّ نَفْسِهِ فَأُولَٰئِكَ هُمُ الْمُفْلِحُونَ. Whoever can protect himself from that inner selfishness, then Allah will make him successful. Incidentally, psychologists have discovered exactly this intrinsic connection between giving and happiness. Psychologists Van Boven and Thomas Gilovich, they tested out individuals that if they were given money as a token, as a bonus, and they were asked, if you were to spend this to buy things which will make you happy, and they were given two choices. Either you spend this money to get happiness by buying things for yourself, so for example, a designer dress or a smartphone, versus spending this money to buy an experience, sharing a meal with someone, or going to a concert with someone, or going on a holiday. Different studies have indicated by these psychologists that invariably, short-term happiness immediately, and long-term happiness even after the event, later on when you just remember the event, short-term and long-term happiness, both of them are more when somebody else is involved. How you spend money, if you share it with someone, you experience more happiness. And there's a reason for that. Elizabeth Dunn and her colleagues in the University of British Columbia, they've conducted numerous studies on the connection between happiness and income and spending. So they would interview individuals about their spending habits, about their habits of giving gifts, about donations, about charity. And they discovered again and again that those who spend on others experience more happiness than those who spend on themselves. Yes, you spend on yourself, you get temporary happiness, but it's not lasting happiness. The happiness reported by those who spend for others is much more. Lottery ticket winners, when they were interviewed, so in the state of Illinois, these investigators picked up random people from the Yellow Book directory, and they also interviewed the lottery ticket winners, and they found and they compared with these two groups, and they discovered that the happiness reported by the non-winners versus the winners, the non-winners are as happy, if not more, than these lottery ticket winners. There is an interesting reason for this. It seems that Allah has designed the human being in such a way that he's hardwired to experience joy and happiness when he shares. Amazing. There is a discipline known as neuroeconomics. So there's a neuroeconomist by the name of William Harbaugh in the University of Oregon. He gives a $100 gift to these experimental subjects, and he puts them under a brain scanner and says, alright, we have used your account, the $100 that you have, part of it we've given away in charity in your name, and now the remaining part, you tell us how would you wish to spend it, for yourself or for some other individual. Meanwhile, they're testing them in the brain scanner. The interesting thing is, if the individual's account has been debited for helping in a charity, and then they also decide to give away in charity, there are certain areas in the brain that they become quite active. The nucleus, the caudate nucleus, and the nucleus accumbens. Incidentally, these are the very deep brain regions. They are the regions of the brain that become active when a person, for example, eats tasty food. They're the regions of the brain that become active when a person is valued and praised. You may deny it. Shaitan may give you some other messages. Shaitan may scare you that if you give in the way of God, that if you give in charity, you may suffer a loss, or your own gratification is delayed. But these are all false. Our brain is designed, our brain is hardwired to experience joy and happiness when we share and we give. And this is exactly what the Quran is trying to tell us. So for example, in Surah Hashr, chapter 59, ayah number 9. وَالَّذِينَ تَبَوَّأُوا الدَّارَ وَالْإِيمَانَ مِنْ قَبْلِهِمْ. And for those who were in Medina, who had settled there before the migrants and the muhajirin came to the Ansar, يُحِبُّونَ مَنْ هَاجَرَ إِلَيْهِمْ. Allah praises them that they love those migrants who come to them, they receive them, they are hospitable, they welcome them, they share their resources and their possessions with these new migrants. وَلَا يَجِدُونَ فِي صُدُورِهِمْ حَاجَةً مِمَّا أُوتُوا. And whatever they have, they are ready to give away. Half. And they don't feel in their hearts any pain or any suffering because of sharing. And number three, وَيُؤْثِرُونَ عَلَىٰ أَنفُسِهِمْ وَلَوْ كَانَ بِهِمْ خَصَاصًا. In fact, they also give more than half. In fact, even when they need it as much as the migrant, even when they need it more than the migrant, they still give away. And Allah is praising them. There's a difference between me not giving, or giving a little, or giving something good quality, or giving so much that it becomes half, or giving more than half, or giving more than half when I need it. This is the sixth level of sacrifice that is being praised in this ayah. وَمَنْ يُوقَ شُحَّ نَفْسِهِ فَأُولَٰئِكَ هُمُ الْمُفْلِحُونَ. Surely he who controls his inner greed and selfishness, they are the ones who are successful. And therefore you notice that in Surah Dahr, when the Ahlul Bayt are being praised, يُوفُونَ بِالنَّذْرِ وَيَخَافُونَ يَوْمًا كَانَ شَرُّهُ مُسْتَطِيرًا وَيُطِعِمُونَ الطَّعَامَ عَلَىٰ حُبِّهِ مِسْكِينًا وَيَتِيمًا وَأَسِيرًا. And they are the ones who feed, not on one occasion, several times, regularly, constantly. It's their habit, they always share. عَلَىٰ حُبِّهِ, despite them loving it or loving him. And they give it to the miskeen and the poor and the orphan and the captive and the prisoner. عَلَىٰ حُبِّهِ can mean they are the ones who give away despite the fact that they need the food. They were fasting, and therefore at the end of the day definitely they were hungry and thirsty. Yet somebody else comes and he's needy and they give it away. So despite the fact that they need the food, they give it away. Or no, Allah is praising them. They are ones who sacrifice despite the fact that not only they need it, but they love this act of giving. Number two. No. عَلَىٰ حُبِّهِ. Not only they need it, not only they love this act of giving, they love this poor man, this orphan, this prisoner. They respect him. Three. No. Not only they give away because they need it, not only they give away because they love this act of giving, because it's an act of a goodness act. And not only because they love the recipient, they do it out of love of God. عَلَىٰ حُبِّهِ مِسْكِينًا وَيَتِيمًا وَأَسِيرًا. إِنَّمَا نُطْعِمُكُمْ لِوَجْهِ اللَّهِ. We feed you for the sake of God. لَا نُرِيدُ مِنْكُمْ جَزَاءً وَلَا شُكُورًا. We don't want a word of appreciation or acknowledgement. We don't even need a word of thanks from you. We do it for the sake of God. Nobody knew about it, but Allah acknowledges and puts it in the Quran till the end of the day of judgment. No. In the same surah, Allah mentions about 10 to 15 rewards that they will be given on the day of judgment. Surah Dahr, chapter 76. Verses 20 onwards, there's a description of the rewards that will be given to these individuals for their sacrifice. So, Number one, فَوَقَاهُمُ اللَّهُ شَرَّ ذَلِكَ الْيَوْمِ. They will be protected from the afflictions of that day. They will be given happiness too. They will be rewarded the Jannah 3, the silk 4, reclining couches 5. There is no heat or cold, which is extreme 6. There will be shade 7. There will be fruits to their beckoning 8. There will be always attended by servants who will bring them wonderful drinks 9. 10, a drink which is mixed with zanjabil, drink from salsabil, served by these eternally handsome youth. If you were to see them, they were just like pearls. And if you were to see the ni'mah Allah has given, it's so wide it can't be even visualized. For them are these beautiful dresses. For them are these gold or are these silver decoration. And finally, for them is the highest drink. All of them, إِنَّ هَذَا كَانَ لَكُمْ جَزَاءً وَكَانَ سَعْيُكُمْ مَشْكُورًا. You didn't ask for thanks. Allah thanked you. And it's not a question of only giving money. Lyubomirsky, she has Sonia. She with her colleagues has conducted a study whereby a group of people were asked to do five acts of goodness and kindness and charity. Nothing to involve with money. So for example, a thank you note to someone, or donating blood, or going to help out somebody. Some of these people did one of these acts on a day of the week. Some of them did several acts on a day in the week. Those who did several acts in a day in the week, they reported 40% more increase in well-being and happiness and health and success compared to the other one. I don't know whether we like it or not. Somehow we are designed inside us to benefit ourselves much more if we benefit others. And this sacrifice was shown by Hazrat Abbas alayhi salam. If there is one person who personifies and embodies, therefore, sacrifice and selflessness, Hazrat Abbas alayhi salam. But before I talk about Hazrat Abbas, he had three brothers, Abdullah, Uthman and Ja'far. Hazrat Abbas tells them, before I sacrifice myself, you proceed. تَقَدَّمْ بَيْنَ يَدَيَّ حَتَّى أَرَاكَ. You will not be able to tolerate my loss, but I am strong enough to be able to tolerate your loss. You proceed first. So Abdullah al-Asghar, the son of Ali ibn Abi Talib from Ummul Banin, 25 years old, he proceeds. One of the companions of Imam Hussein alayhi salam by the name of Dhahhak bin Abdullah al-Mishrafi, who was with Imam Hussein alayhi salam, who made a pact with Imam, he said that I will come and support you so long as there is no danger. But if I see on the day of Ashura that there is danger, then allow me to escape. And Imam says, well, come and help as much as you can. He came on the day of Ashura when he saw the companions falling one after the other. He came to Imam, he says, as agreed upon, I have to leave. And Imam says, but the enemy has attacked all our horses. How are you going to escape? He says, no, I've hidden one horse. He went and got his horse and he galloped away. He reports some of the battle cries. He says the battle cry of Abdullah al-Asghar, the son of Imam Ali, the brother of Abbas. أنا ابن ذي النجدة والإفضال ذاك علي الخير ذو الفعال سيف رسول الله ذو النكال في كل يوم ظاهر الأهوال. If you don't know me, let me introduce myself. I'm the son of that man who was the brave one and full of merits. Proud about Imam Ali alayhi salam. I'm the one, the son of Ali, the virtuous one. The one who was active and dynamic in all fields against falsehood. I'm the son of the sword of the Prophet. The one who defended the Prophet. I'm the son of the punishment of God against the enemies of God. I'm the son of the man who was there in every tragedy that the Prophet faced to defend him and to protect him. proudly he comes on the battlefield and associates himself with Imam Ali alayhi salam. The second son, Uthman bin Ali ibn Abi Talib. Imam Ali named him Uthman because one of the great companions of the Prophet was Uthman bin Maz'un, whom Imam Ali liked. So in memory, he names his second son from Ummul Banin as Uthman. When Uthman comes to the battlefield, إِنِّي أَنَا عُثْمَانُ ذُو الْمَفَاخِرِ شَيْخِ عَلِيٌّ ذُو الْفَعَالِ الطَّاهِرِ هَذَا حُسَيْنٌ سَيِّدُ الْأَخَائِرِ سيد الأصاغر والأكابر بعد الرسول والوصي الناصر. If you don't know me, let me introduce myself. I'm Uthman, full of honor, because my father Ali is the one who was active in all fields, and he was a pure one, pure in his thoughts and pure in his behavior and pure in his character. And this is Hussein now after Ali, the chief of all the virtuous ones, the head of all the leader of all the elders and the young ones after the Prophet, and the Wasi who never abandoned the Prophet, and therefore me, I will never abandon the representative of the Wasi. Notice that these battle cries all declare the very reasons why these opponents were condemned, and they were and these helpers and supporters and the family members of Imam Hussein alayhi salam proudly announced the reasons for their sacrifice. The third brother, the youngest brother of Abbas, Ja'far bin Ali. Inni ana Ja'farun zul ma'ali, najlu aliyin il khayri zul nawali, zakal wasiyu zul sana wal wali, hasbi bi ammi Ja'farin wal khali, ahmi Husaynan zan nada wal mifdali. Again, very proud about his father. This time, Ja'far mentions his uncle, Ja'far ibn Abi Talib. If you don't know me, I am Ja'far, full of honor. I am the son of Ali, the virtuous one, the one who was very generous and compassionate and sacrificing. He was therefore the righteous successor. And he was the righteous authority. For me, enough is my honor that I am associated with Ja'far ibn Abi Talib, who is my uncle. And I will defend with every drop of my blood this man, Husaynan, the brave one, the one who is virtuous. So notice the motivation for the sacrifice of these brothers of Abbas. Now comes Abbas himself, why he turns out to be even more superior than all. It comes to Imam Hussein alayhi salam that all the elders now have sacrificed. I can't bear it anymore. Allow me to go to the battlefield. I don't know, we don't know precisely why is it that Imam Hussein alayhi salam does not grant permission. Ali Akbar, permission granted. Qasim, indirectly permission granted. But for Hazrat Abbas, Imam says, no, you can go to collect water, yes. Abbas is the Saqqah. He has managed before the 10th on two occasions to go. Despite all the guards and the soldiers, there were hundreds. No, there were thousands guarding the water. Nobody should get access. He managed to open up and get the water and bring. 4,000 guarding the water. So Abbas alayhi salam proceeds. He reaches the Furat, the Euphrates. His horse enters. He fills the water bags. In fact, the water must have reached right to the belly of the horse. All he has to do is just lower himself and take water. People saw him, he took water in his hands, but then he threw it away. What happened? What was he thinking? It's after he came out, when he gave the battle cry, that we understand what was going in his mind. Ya nafsu min ba'di al-Husayni huni. فبعده لا كنت أن تكوني هذا حسين شارب المنون تشربين بارد المعين والله ما هذا فعال ديني. Oh my nafs, oh you're thirsty, you are tired, it's very hot, you've come here to defend the cause of truth. It's just a question of taking a few drops, get a little more strength, defend Imam Hussein even more. Well, what's wrong with drinking a few drops? It's in the good cause. But Abba says, no. Imam Hussein hasn't drunk a drop of water. Yes, I want to defend himself, but I will not defend him with any situation where I suffer lesser than him. That's the sacrifice of this man. The love, the respect, the submission, the loyalty, the sacrifice for his Mawla, to the point that whatever you suffer, I will not suffer less. He comes out. He takes up a strategy whereby he is to take the water bags back to the camp, but not through the area where the army is located. He has to somehow deflect them. So he enters an area where there are date palm trees to be able to take protection of the date palm trees. He enters there. We don't know, there is a clash that takes place, but in his battle cries we come to know something very serious is happening. لا أرهب الموت إذ الموت رقى حتى أوارى في المصاليت لقى نفسي لنفس المصطفى الطهري وقى إني أنا العباس أغدو بالسقى. I'm not scared of dying. You can come as many as you want, hundreds, thousands. I will protect the cause of truth. I am ready to drown in the sea of the swords, but I will not give up the defense of Hussein. My nafs be sacrificed for this great Mawla. He has given me the task of delivering water. This is what I will do. La akhafu sharra al-yawm al-multaqa. The fight continues and his battle cry now begins to change. Wallahi in qata'tum yamini inni uhami abadan an dini an imamin sadiq al-yaqini najl an-nabiy at-tahir al-amini. I swear if you come and cut off my right hand, I will never give up defending the faith. But what is this hand? It's just a means and a tool. It's the soul and the spirit. I have the determination. I have the strength of resolve. I've seen the truth. This truth is much greater than the totality of all of you who are here. You don't intimidate me. You don't threaten me. It's your dastardly, cowardly act that you have chopped off my right hand. I will forever defend the righteous Imam, because he is the son, the righteous successor of the pure, trustworthy Prophet. What your leaders are the evil ones. And you have submitted yourself to the evil ones. Next, Abbas alayhi salam's battle cry now changes. Now he says, Ya nafsu la takhsha min al-kuffari wa abshiri bi rahmati al-jabbari ma'a an-nabiy as-sayyid al-mukhtari qad qata'u bi baghyihim yasari fa aslihim ya rabbi harra an-nari. Oh my nafs, my left hand has now been chopped off. Nafs, you are bleeding, you are suffering, you are in pain. The pain is becoming unbearable. But oh nafs, don't be intimidated. Oh nafs, remember the mercy of God and the reward of God of this sacrifice is much greater than this little pain that you experience. Nafs, you will be in the company of the chosen Prophet. Nafs, they have been unjust in denying you the opportunity to serve the children of Imam Hussein. Oh Lord, send them to the fire of hell. Look at the way Abbas alayhi salam is strengthening his resolve and not flinching even for a moment in his supreme sacrifice. We don't have cases of other individuals who went to the battlefield and faced this systematic limb by limb being severed in the way of God. And finally, when he falls, he cries out. Imam Hussein alayhi salam comes immediately on the deathbed. He finds an amazing, horrific situation. Here is Abbas lying. He has been struck on his head. There is an arrow in his eyes. His hands have been chopped off. His body is all wounded. At that time, I would like to quote one eulogy which is recited by Ummul Banin. When the caravan comes back from captivity back to Medina, Ummul Banin meets them and asks them, we want to report to you what happened about your sons. And she says, no, I'm not interested to know what happened to my sons. Tell me what happened to Hussein. And then when she knows that her sons have been sacrificed for the sake of Imam Hussein, she cries out. She says, I was not in Karbala, but those who were there and those who saw my son Abbas, they tell me that just like my other sons, just like their father Haider, they attacked on the cowardly army. They tell me that Abbas was struck on his head. أُنْبِئْتُ أَنَّ إِبْنِ أُصِيبَ بِرَأْسِهِ مَقْطُوعَ يَدٍ ويلي على شبلي أمال برأسه ضرب العمد لو كان سيفك في يديك لما دنا منه أحد. I'm sure, Abbas, if your hands had not been severed, there is no way nobody could have touched Hussein. And that is why Imam Hussein now, in those last moments, says, الآن انكسر ظهري وقلت حيلتي. Now my means have been taken away from me. My backbone, my pillar of support is broken. Assalamu alayk ya Aba al-Fadl al-Abbas ibn Amir al-Mu'mineen. O the one who sacrificed himself for his brother. O the one who prepared his next life with the sacrifice in this life. O the one who protected. O the one who was selfless. O the one who did his best just to bring water, nothing more. Or the one who gave up his hands in the way of God. La'anallahu qatilayhi Yazid bin Ruqad and Hakim bin Tufail. Imam Zamana in Ziyarat Nahiya says, may Allah curse his two killers. Assalamu ala al-Husayn wa ala Ali ibn al-Husayn wa ala awlad al-Husayn wa ala ashab al-Husayn jami'un wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Ya Husayn.
Ya Hussein, Ya Hussein.